Well, good afternoon. My name is Chris Schlecht, and I'm going to work through a series of three lectures collectively under the title Church and Family in Modern America. And the first one is going to feature the church. And I want to talk about women's ordination, and that's where we're going to begin. In June of 1930, a Presbyterian church outside Milwaukee ordained Sarah E. Dixon to the office of ruling elder. The next day, the paper, Milwaukee Sentinel, reported that history had been made. She was the first woman to be regularly ordained to the ruling eldership in the entire history of American Presbyterianism, a history that stretches back to 1706. Just a few days prior to this event, the denomination's General Assembly in 1930 changed its book of order to allow such a thing to take place. So Milwaukee's Sarah Dixon became a first in history. And over the next year, a handful of other women across the country became ruling elders in their Presbyterian churches. And the following General Assembly in 31 seated five women as voting delegates. My study explores why this took place. How did it come about that Protestants began ordaining women to church office in the period between the two world wars? Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopalians, Baptists, Congregationalists all wrestled with this question in the interwar period. The answer has to do with church bulletins, and I'll get that get more to that in a moment. The larger story of women's ordination, I'm going to argue, has less to do with a shift in theology as it did with a shift in the everyday routines of Protestant religious practice. Many have said that our practices flow out of our theology, but let's not forget that our theology often flows out of our practices just as well. History is not just about big ideas or the big actions of big leaders. History is also about the everyday habits and routines and behaviors in the daily lives of ordinary people. Why do we care? Why do we care? Well, this past year alone, we've been confronted with dizzying cultural changes related to the identity of men and women. The very notions of male and female are shifting before our eyes. Last year witnessed the first women to complete ranger training for the United States Army without any adjustments having been made to the standards. Last season, the National Football League hired two women as officials, and the Phoenix Cardinals hired a woman onto its coaching staff to coach linebackers. In December, Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that there is no role in any branch of the United States military that any woman may not fill. All restrictions based on sex have been removed. And of course, last summer, the United States Supreme Court declared that same-sex couples have a fundamental right to marry in the Obergefell decision. Now, I don't want to suggest that we can draw a straight line of causation that treats today's developments in gender and sexuality as a direct consequence of women's ordination in 1930. Today's developments resulted from a whole lot more than just that. I'm taking us back to the 20s and 30s, not so much as a quest for some kind of origin story to get us to where we got to where we are today, but rather to look at another historical instance when a major gendered shift occurred. We have the benefit of hindsight when we look back at the interwar period, and so we gain the clarity that comes from observing cultural change from a distance. A particular kind of clarity that's certainly unavailable to us when we examine cultural changes that we're living through. The fact that the 20s and 30s was a different time than our own then is also helpful. One of the best ways to understand the peculiarities of your own culture is to travel to a different one. And this is precisely the kind of benefit that history always offers. The story of women's ordination and the cultural context that produced it takes us to a different context in many respects than ours. But it remains helpful because it's a story about gendered change, and it can help us better understand how these things come about. Which brings me back to my introductory observation, and I want you to know where I'm heading. The story of women's ordination is not actually a story about the influence of theological change. The story reminds us that there are plenty of other motivating factors behind human action besides theological reflection. Humans do things other than theologize. You don't get to know a person fully by simply getting to know their theology. We all know this. How much more true is this when historians try to get to know a whole time period? Unfortunately, I've seen a lot of church historians limit their gaze to theological ideas when they examine the past, and in doing so, they often overlook some of the most crucial developments that shaped the Christian church. History is much broader than the history of big ideas that people are thinking. Church history is much broader than the history of the theological ideas that church people think. I'm going to be the last one to criticize the study of historical theology. I'm not criticizing that. I'm criticizing the notion of a steady diet and an exclusive diet of that. I think that the history of ideas is very important, and I engage in that sort of analysis in my own thinking quite a lot. My complaint is with the tendency on the part of some to rush to the history of ideas as if ideas are the only key that's going to open the door to our understanding of the past. Now, historians of American religion rightly describe the 1920s as a decade of theological controversy and change. We see creation, evolution, fundamentalism, modernism. But Protestants also wrestled with issues that are not reducible to bare theological ideas. Women bobbed their hair and put on makeup. Dancing, movies, prohibition, jazz, poverty, children in the workplace, divorce, all of these things. As you read Protestants and their magazines, these were definite preoccupations of their attention. Now, when it comes to the issue of women's ordination, most historians have tried to account for the change in women's status in the church by examining theological discourse about women. But the theological arguments for women's ordination that ultimately prevailed at the end of the 1920s were the same old arguments that had already been around for two generations. In fact, the most widely referenced book in the ordination debates of the 1920s was a book that was published way back in 1889. The arguments for women's ordination had not changed. They hadn't even been dressed up in new form. They hadn't even been revised or updated. But now in the 1920s, these old and familiar arguments finally met a favorable hearing. So if the theology of women isn't what changed, what did? That's the question I aim to answer. And we find the answer once again by examining everyday routines, material objects, even architectural space, all of which reveal ultimately this conclusion, an administrative revolution that transformed American Protestantism in the early decades of the 20th century. I argue that this administrative revolution came freighted with gendered significance and fueled the change in women's status in churches. And so, here we are. I argue that the rise of women's ordination had to do less with changes in theology, which usually historians point to, than it had to do with an administrative transformation that swept across American Protestantism in the early 20th century. So, I'm going to approach this first by describing this administrative transformation, and that's going to lead us to talk about all kinds of interesting things, and then second, to explain the gendered implications of it all. So we'll leave the particular issue of women's ordination aside for the moment and talk about what I call this administrative transformation first. At the turn of the 20th century, Protestants across the United States placed administration at the center of their religious practice in a new way. They consolidated their missionary and educational and benevolence organizations. They integrated local, regional, and national expressions of church life. They extolled organizational efficiency as the cardinal virtue of a unique renewal movement. Over the centuries, Christians have met Jesus in various ways, in prayer. Others encountered him in the waters of baptism or at the communion table. Still others have found Jesus in seclusion, in miracles, in fasting and other deprivations, in performing selfless acts of charity, in music, in soul-stirring sermons. In the early 20th century, American Protestants met Jesus by organizing. They partook of divine grace in activities that could be diagrammed on flowcharts, tallied in ledgers, organized in filing cabinets, printed in bulletins, moved, seconded, adopted, and recorded in minutes. Time allows me to consider only a few facets of this transformation, but it was vast and far-reaching. I'm going to look at architecture, I'm going to look at record keeping, I'm going to look at the habits of giving, and I'll get to church bulletins in a moment. But let's begin with architecture. Finally, I'll bring it back to women's ordination. But I want to begin with ecclesiastical architecture. A lot of people like to study medieval cathedrals. Ecclesiastical architecture, I think, is always important to study. The physical fabric in which we worship is deeply important. Well, why not at the turn of the century? Arch Street Presbyterian Church here in Philadelphia is a landmark in downtown Philly. It was built in 1913. These slides, as we look around Arch Street Presbyterian Church, what I want to show you, I've looked, gone into the archives and the plans of Arch Street here, but a new development, an office, a church office. Offices were new ecclesiastical spaces in the early 20th century. You can see this here. I'll take you to Idlewild Presbyterian Church, 1928. Beautiful building. This is what it looks like. It's in its interior. This was held forth as a model church, written up in architecture magazines. We also have the church office, a very important feature that becomes ubiquitous during this time. Other interesting features that I could describe, talking about its gymnasium, operating this vast Sunday school program that they had here. Now, to generalize this, the American Architect, the leading trade magazine for architecture, in 1925, offers advice to architects about how to design a church. And of course, we have the office as a very important feature. This is just a generalized floor plan of a new church. The same magazine, if you go back 25 years earlier, you're not going to see the office. Another different article in the American Architect magazine, 25 years earlier, no church offices. Now, we had pastors' studies that date back as long as there have been Protestant churches. Pastors' studies are designed for sermon prep, perhaps counseling, although most counseling was done in the form of visitation before the automobile. But it was a place for Sunday sermon prep with theological books and a writing desk. That's what a pastor's study is. But a church office is a different kind of space, and it's populated with different kinds of physical objects. What happened in these office spaces? A number of things happened. The demands of congregational life became what one observer described as a seven-day task. It was no longer the case that churches were busy only on Sundays. There were youth programs, women's societies, prayer meetings, a daily buzz of congregational activity that required coordination and staffing to manage. Sunday schools increased in enrollment and in sophistication, and required specialized management. They tracked enrollments and attendance. They tracked progress toward the next grade levels. Curricular norms became standardized across denominations. They were often tied to denominational publishing houses that produced graded Sunday school materials, and they increasingly supplied training and standards for Sunday school teachers. These are standard charts. You see the beginnings of charts and graphs here. That describe these sorts of things. This template from 1920 Presbyterian General Assembly is a template for what records to keep. You see, as the denomination headquarters starts to compile more and more records, then there needs to be a standardization of record keeping across the constituent churches all around the country. This is the existence of a template then for what records to keep. Becomes very important. It's interesting, as I go into archives, to watch how reports and minutes from different local churches lose their local idiosyncrasies in their formatting and start to look more and more alike, because they're being submitted to denominational authorities, collecting all of this data, that sort of thing, and that creates the need for formulas and standardization and so forth. Pledge envelopes. One of the most interesting administrative developments was the pledging system. Pledging requires individual donors to declare how much money they're going to give in the future. Denominational officials imposed this practice after managers of denominational agencies started preparing budgets, budgets for their Sunday school programs, budgets for their mission societies, and of course, budgeting requires making projections into the future. Prior to the 20th century, boards and agencies were sustained by parishioners' offerings that were collected in local churches and sent in to the various agencies. And whatever was sent in is what they had to spend. But what if you want to plan what you're going to spend next year? Then you need to plan what you're going to collect next year as well. And that means that the individual parishioner needs to plan what he's going to give in the next year. 1912, the Presbyterian General Assembly replaced the old practice with a pledge system so it could predict the level of support for denominational boards in advance of each fiscal year. The idea of a fiscal year itself was something that was relatively recent in ecclesiastical life. This system required local churches to restructure the way they collected funds, and more importantly, it called upon individual parishioners to change the way they gave. To facilitate the collection of pledges, denominations, publishing houses printed and distributed pledge cards for distribution to individual church members, and then managers trained small teams in every church to call on parishioners and present them with a card so that they could fill out how much they're going to pledge Sunday after Sunday. Parishioners would record on the card specific amounts they promised to give over the next year, and they designated pledges both to the local church and to the denominational causes. They call this double budget subscription. And then to make it easier to collect the pledges week after week, the denomination furnished printed envelopes. So you're going to pledge a certain amount each Sunday, then you will receive 52 envelopes over the next year. The most popular were double pocket envelopes, numbered and dated for each week of the year. If you missed a Sunday, of course, it was really good for the denomination because you'd have this dated envelope. Oh, you know, if you miss church some Sunday, you don't give that Sunday. Oh, but with the new system, we have a record that you didn't give that Sunday and a reminder in the form of the envelope. To ensure uniform recording of pledges and collections, the denomination supplies record sheets for treasurers in every church. Treasurers in every church, yes, very important. The new pledge system routinized Christian charity by linking denominational headquarters to every individual church member through a system of regional administrators. In the words of the Presbyterian General Assembly, this new budgeting system brings the individual subscriber into close touch with his own church and with the great worldwide enterprises undertaken by the Presbyterian Church as a whole. It results in giving a business system to our financial methods. Presbyterians heralded this vertical integration as a sacred achievement, and such a coordinated system of church organization, as they said, magnifies weekly giving as an act of worship. Now, these images here are about double pocket envelopes that you can order. Most of them are for Baptist churches because Presbyterians, of course, printed their own. The Baptist churches, they had to, individual churches would order them. But that's what you see in the image here. This brings us to another type of, let's come back to ecclesiastical architecture. The denominational headquarters buildings as well start to populate the American landscape. What's happening in these church offices? Well, they're dealing with, through systems of intermediate management and coordination and control, knitting themselves together increasingly to a denominational headquarters. So here we see one of the earliest ones. Many of them began with the publishing houses of the great denomination. So the Methodist Book Concern in New York. Here's a contemporary picture of it. My favorite, well, one of my favorites in New York, the Presbyterian building. This is where the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions was housed on Fifth Avenue in New York. This is what it looks like today. And if you go there on the ground floor, Sarah Jessica Parker has a shoe shop in its current usage. Beautiful building, Congregational House in Boston, Massachusetts. There's a picture of a horse and carriage out in front of it, and then a contemporary picture. And if you watched that old law show, Ally McBeal, it was the exterior shots for the Cajun Fish Law Firm, the old Congregational House. But my absolute favorite is the Witherspoon Building in Philadelphia, which was the initial home of the publishing house for denominational publications, and it became the ultimate denominational headquarters. It's a beautiful building. I've stood outside this for hours trying to photograph it. Witherspoon Building, it's got all these medallions here. There's the Gospels and Presbyterian Board of Publication and Sabbath School work. It's got all these images with Westminster Church of Scotland, Church of Ireland. A bank is in here today. I could just go on and on around that building. It's fantastic. But also in Philadelphia, the Schaff Building from the German Reformed Church. And a more recent photograph of it. So we have a new type of ecclesiastical architecture in the form of the headquarters buildings that matches the rise of office spaces within the local church buildings. I had asked the question, what's happening in these office spaces? And I've answered that with many, many different things, but I need to get to newsletters and bulletins, which is one of the most important functions to take place in church offices. In the early 20th century, Protestants across the United States began turning out form letters, bulletins, calendars, and newsletters. All this locally generated printed material allowed parishioners to keep abreast of needs to meet, causes to support, events to take part in all throughout the week. Their publications announced events coming ahead. They helped members stay abreast of progress in fundraising, outreach work, and other projects. Seniors in the church could learn what the kids were up to and vice versa. Parents could take pride in seeing their children's accomplishment in print. Through the material they printed in their local churches, Protestants rallied parishioners to action, solidified their ties to hometown religious communities, and even drew prospective members into the buzz and camaraderie of congregational life. By the 1920s, most American Protestants received a printed bulletin when they entered a house of worship on Sunday morning. But this development was as new to their religious routine as arriving to worship by automobile, and we need to remember that. Augustine didn't have a church bulletin, neither did Jonathan Edwards. The faithful enlisted small-time Hearsts and Pulitzers as religious workers who inked and turned the drums of their tabletop duplicating machines and forged a new print culture that reshaped their religious communities. Now, historians have long observed the history of print cultures in the early 20th century, how mass printing aimed at the everyman helped to construct a national consumer identity. New financing mechanisms and transportation networks allowed publishers, writers, and advertisers to set down their values in print and to spread them across the coffee tables around the country. I've found a similar process at work in local church contexts with the advent of church newsletters and church bulletins. Among the most significant dimensions of the broader administrative transformation that I've been speaking to, I think, is this. My research traces what became of this localized print culture and the administrative transformation that's part of the bigger picture that it inhabits. And there are ultimately two consequences. The first consequence is a shift away from forming religious identity around personal bonds and toward a less personal, mediated notion of religious solidarity. In previous eras, the Protestant faithful had defined sacred communities around face-to-face Sunday gatherings by hearing sermons, singing hymns, praying together, and other ritual acts. Now, Protestants shape congregational identity by printing paper, disseminating, and reading it. And then second, printing, together with other forms of administration, opened new opportunities for women in Protestant religious life. I promise to get to women's ordination at the outset. Bear with me a little while longer. I'll get there. But more on printing here for the moment and what can be said about all this administrative transformation. I want to unpack how this story of print arose. The mimeograph was one of the first small printing machines to be produced in large numbers. Albert B. Dick, portrayed here, of Chicago, gave the mimeograph its name in 1887. That was the year he secured licensing rights from the fellow who had invented it, whose name was Thomas Edison. It fit easily onto a desktop or table and required little training to operate. It produced a printed page by mechanically pressing an ink-filled pad over a stencil and leave behind an image on paper. Operators typically made stencils with an ordinary typewriter with this special waxed paper then that would create the stencil and you'd put it into your mimeograph. Stencils usually deteriorated over the course of a print run, but nonetheless, the mimeograph made small run duplication feasible, and many organizations found these devices useful. The mimeograph competed in popularity with another duplicating machine called the multigraph, a little bit more expensive, but probably a little better in some ways. The multigraph was manufactured by a Cleveland-based American Multigraph Company, which had formed in 1902. Like the mimeograph, the multigraph could rest on an office table and was pretty easy to operate. It featured a round drum faced with slots that you could put movable type onto. By the second decade of the 20th century, American Multigraph produced a separate typesetting device that made it fairly easy to put that type onto the drum, and that's the device here on the right. Once the drum then is set with type, the operator would turn it by hand, or a little later you could plug it in, it would turn by electricity, and the turning drum pressed the type through an ink-filled ribbon and onto the paper. And this created our printed page. Because the multigraph printed with type rather than with a stencil, it usually produced higher quality lettering than a mimeograph did. And it was also capable of larger print runs because it didn't have a stencil that deteriorated over the course of producing a lot of copies. American Multigraph became one of Cleveland's most important industries. There's the building today. The building still stands. Another device, to save the labor of typing individual addresses, many well-outfitted churches purchased another new machine called an addressograph, also a tabletop contraption. It had a hopper, and operators loaded a stack of metal plates, each of which was embossed a unique address. So you can imagine you could print your newsletter, leave this space for an address, and then you'd have your printed newsletters here, and you'd have these little cards with an embossed little plate in it. Think of like an army dog tag, this little metal plate, and that would have a unique address. You'd put the addresses into the hopper and it could produce, one card would go through and it would print the address on the stack of papers. That's an addressograph. The Chicago-based addressograph company dominated this market. And in the late 1920s, engineers developed a way to combine the operations of the multigraph and addressograph into one machine, and the two companies merged in 1931 to form the Addressograph Multigraph Company. This graphotype actually makes the little metal plates, and then here is an addressograph multigraph right here on the right. The Addressograph Multigraph Company had branch offices in cities all across the country, and it was one of the most conspicuous advertisers in business magazines. Tracking these advertisements is pretty interesting. This is from 1922, multigraph advertisement, and it highlights the different uses. Later in 1922, we see its advertisements. Here's the users right here. Look, churches appear in 1922, marketing directly to churches. When the periodical Church Management was launched in 1924, American Multigraph purchased big, huge display ads, especially aimed at churches. This is a pastor here working on his multigraph. The pastors of many churches are extolling the advantages of this new device. Here's an address-a-graph ad. It's one of the best time savers we have from Central Presbyterian Church in Brooklyn, New York. Let's see. Here's an advertisement by an engraver who is selling cuts for church bulletins that can be attached to a multigraph drum. You want to get some graphics in here? Well, you can buy this little stamp thing that's designed to go into your multigraph drum. And this ad reveals that duplicating machines had become so ubiquitous in churches that it produced an aftermarket, where new entrepreneurs could develop products and sell them on the assumption that churches naturally, obviously, own these machines. So here, you know, we're smashing records fast in Sunday school. We want you, or the mission study classes are circling the globe, and there's a nice art that you to spice up your church newsletters. All right. The mimeograph, the multigraph, the addressograph have allowed Protestants to turn their local churches into small publishing and mailing houses. Before the advent of these machines, only a handful of large urban churches could publish their own bulletins and newsletters. And they had the financial resources and easy access to professional printers. But as these new machines proliferated, many smaller and less affluent churches became little publishing houses. So what became of it? One Methodist, an expert in church publicity named Christian Reasoner, urged Protestants to embrace desktop duplicators. And he explained why. He says, when church members see their own religious activities described in print, they solidify their own connection to the local church. Here's what Reasoner says. It puts folks on their mettle when they recognize that people will be watching them as a member of the church in print. He went on to say that when parishioners read about what other church members are up to, they realize that they are not, in his words, they're not wholly alone in the community. Parishioners began identifying with one another through their shared experience of reading about local church life. They participated vicariously in church activities they hadn't even attended by reading about them. Another church management expert summed it up well when he praised a church bulletin because it was excellent for cementing the thought of the people to the church. For all its purported benefits, small-scale printing entered church life at a cost. A community formed around print surrenders a measure of personal contact. An obvious advantage that print has over real-time face-to-face human contact is its capacity to reach more people and with greater regularity. Writing can stretch across distances and it can outlive individual people, but writing can do these things only because writing is to a degree an impersonal realm. Writing is not a human body. And so it doesn't have the limitations, but it doesn't have the advantages of a human body. Socrates famously observed that writing separates human bodies from one another and inserts paper and ink in between them. Writers can write without having any personal contact with readers, and readers are reduced to an undifferentiated class stripped of their individual qualities. The implications for church life can be seen through the first introduction of printed form letters into mainstream pastoral practice. The multigraph turned out effective form letters. Unlike copies generated by mimeograph, readers could not tell any difference between a multigraphed copy and a unique personal original that had been created by typewriter. Multigraph users learned to leave a blank space on each copy where an addressee's name and address could be individually typed, or better yet, printed using an addressograph. This ability to add personal names and addresses to a multigraphed copy transformed the way pastors communicated to parishioners. The conventions of letter writing that date back to medieval times, long before Gutenberg invented movable type, had long solidified the form and structure of the personal letter. Those who wrote form letters learned to imitate these familiar conventions. Although they appeared just like personal letters, form letters delivered a uniform, duplicated message to a large number of recipients, undifferentiated from one another, all at once. In short, multigraphs and mimeographs made it possible for pastors to send out impersonal messages posing as personal ones. Because form letters were so new to church life, many pastors sought advice about how to create them. An article appeared in Church Management in 1924, I believe it was, coached pastors on how to compose what he described as form letters to unseen groups. The phrase is revealing, form letters to unseen groups. It indicates a shift from personal to impersonal in pastoral care. Overwhelming reader response to this initial article convinced the magazine's editor in Church Management, I've read this series, it published a regular advice column on how to write form letters that appeared in every month's issue. Advice about writing form letters became a regular topic in practical church manuals that became popular in the 10s and 20s, and also in denominational magazines. Presbyterian pastor Ralph Gilbert devoted an entire chapter to form letters in his 1925 manual titled The Church and Printer's Ink. The key to a successful form letter, Gilbert said, was to hide the impersonal nature of the mass message and to make it appear personal. This is the only way for a pastor to bridge the rhetorical distance that form letters introduce between himself and his parishioners. William Stidger, a Methodist, prescribed specific strategies for, as he said, disguising the fact that it's a form letter. And he, above all, he advised that form letters must be copied using typefaces that imitate those used in typewriters because typewriters are associated with individual person-to-person communication. He counseled pastors to create form letters with a multigraph then instead of a mimeograph, and he also advised them to sign each copy of a form letter by hand. And if large print runs made hand signing onerous, he advised get a cut made of your signature. Have an engraver make your signature that you can attach it to the drum. He promised that it looks like a real signature to give the psychological effect of a signature. All this effort that went into camouflaging the impersonal nature of form letters indicates that most Protestants still valued personal face-to-face interaction as the norm for pastoral care. Form letters, of course, came up short of the ideal, so pastors had to develop rhetorical strategies to compensate. Now, that's a comment on print culture, but I want to widen our gaze to other elements of administration that were coming on at the time. The impersonal nature of print culture is just one facet of the much wider trend toward impersonalism that the administrative revolution brought to congregational life. Administration actually emerged as a specialized work around the turn of the 20th century. One of the fathers of the movement, Frederick Winslow Taylor, was a pioneer and leading proponent of the theory of scientific management. He studied workflows in industry with an aim to maximize efficiency in the expenditure of time and of money and of human labor in the production process. The influence of Taylor and others launched management as a field all its own. In the late 1900s, we see Harvard finally offering its MBA, the first Master of Business Administration. Managerial pioneers inspired new thinking in arenas other than manufacturing. Morris Cook adapted scientific management principles to the field of education. Christine Frederick applied them to housewifery, pioneering the field of home economics. William Leffingwell, portrayed here, applied them to the various clerical functions in office settings, which is going to bring us back to the church office here. And Protestants applied them to their religious practice. Shaler Matthews, who was a prominent, very important Baptist leader and ecumenical organizer, urged Protestants to apply Frederick Winslow Taylor's ideas to their church operations. And his 1912 book, Scientific Management in the Churches, contributed to a rising demand for administrative expertise in Protestant church life. Tons of practical handbooks also appeared during this time. And when you do this kind of research, it really gets kind of interesting here. Magara was an important name, Modern Church Program, Finance, Principles and Practice, Practical Interchurch Methods, Modern Church Management, A Study in Efficiency, How to Make a Church Go. William Leach was another prominent writer, Manual on Publicity, Church Finance, Raising, Spending, Accounting, Church Administration. These are the sorts of things that I read when I study church history around the turn of the century, and the proliferation of this literature is really quite striking. So accountants, managers, and efficiency experts emerged as the important figures in American Protestantism in this era. The Presbytery of Chicago became convinced that pastors needed executive assistance to help them lead their churches. So in 1908, they launched a school to prepare efficiency experts for church work called the Presbyterian Training School. You see an advertisement for it on the right. This institution drew students by pointing out that efficiency is one of the slogans of the times. The school met a demand for church personnel who could help Protestants adapt new fiscal and organizational methods to their religious practice. And now, let's get to the question of women's ordination. In the quest to maximize efficiency, Presbyterians confronted the question of what place to give women in this newly ordered religious life. The push for efficiency introduced ambiguity about the relationship between administration and spirituality. Frederick Winslow Taylor, the father of scientific management, had taught that because humans are the chief sources of mistakes and inefficiencies, the key to efficiency lies in the removal of human idiosyncrasies from the productive process. Taylor termed older approaches to productivity as personal management and set his own scientific approach over against the personal. The fact that the opposite of scientific management is personal management is revealing. Taylor wrote, "In the past, the man has been first. In the future, the system must be first." He envisioned administrators as objective and purely rational beings, stripped of individual personality, and these specialists served impersonal systems. By downplaying an administrator's personality in the workplace, these new functionaries defied easy categorization as either masculine or feminine. Should administration be man's work, like splitting wood or tempering steel? Or was it women's work, like mending clothing or washing pots and pans? In these early years of scientific management, administrators could be either masculine or feminine. They were sort of androgynous. By the 1920s, women had already proven themselves to be capable organizers in both civic and church life. Women's organizations had long promoted literacy, education, temperance, positive poverty relief, women's suffrage. These organizations formed networks, combined resources, and grew increasingly sophisticated in their administrative structures. The Presbytery of Chicago's training school, again this advertisement on the right, sought enrollees from the ranks of women. Its advertising assured prospective women applicants that efficiency experts in the church played a different role than that of pastors, and that women's involvement in church administration would not disturb traditional hierarchies that link spiritual leadership and masculinity. One advertisement explained, it's this one here, the worthwhile efficiency expert doesn't try to run the business, he cooperates with its head and helps carry out agreed upon plans. It went on to say, young women inclined to such service should write for information. The educational superintendent of the Presbyterian Board of Sabbath School Work made a similar clarification when he called for administrative expertise in Presbyterian Sunday schools. He proclaimed that the local church needs an educational engineer, one technically and ecclesiastically competent to take charge, control movements, and secure results. Yet such a position carried no spiritual authority, he said, noting that an engineer is not a boss, he's a constructive expert. Because an administrator's presence in church organizations did not trouble gendered hierarchies, women could fill these new positions just as men could. And this consideration became a new factor in discussions about whether the traditional ecclesiastical titles should be conferred upon women. Printing helps to illustrate the point. Let's come back once again to printing, kind of my lead example in all of this. What to make of these small duplicating machines, the mimeograph and multigraph? Are they like a typewriter, which by the 1920s had become gendered as a woman's machine? Or were they like printers, which by the 1920s had become gendered as a machine that a man operates? What do you do with this desktop duplicator? Is it like the familiar typewriter, or is it like the familiar printer? Masculine, feminine. Who can work this? So let's see. The gendered ambiguity of small printing machines shows up in a 1922 practical guide titled The Expert Typist. This book includes a full chapter on the mimeograph, offering illustrated step-by-step instructions about how to operate and service the machine. Some of the photos for the steps show the machine being operated by a man, like here, this is one of the steps, but then another step is clearly being operated by a woman. Unlike typewriters, which had become associated with women's work, unlike printing machines, which had been associated with man's work, these desktop duplicators were ambiguous. We see this in other advertisements. I'm pointing to the advertisement that I'd already put up here previously. This is portrayed as a pastor, clearly with the shirt sleeves rolled up, but then we have a woman operating a device here. We also see women operating the stencil duplicators and so forth. This brings us back then to my central question. Why, in 1930, after a decade of debate, did Presbyterians approve the ordination of women as ruling elders? The decision had less to do with shifting views of women than it did shifting views of the office of ruling elder and what it meant. In an earlier era, prior to this administrative revolution, the ruling eldership was an office of spiritual authority. Ruling elders assisted ministers in the spiritual oversight of the church, whereas ministers or the clergy preached and administered sacraments. The vote to admit women to the ruling eldership indicated that the meaning of the office had shifted away from spiritual leadership, which was associated with masculinity, and to administrative function, which was impersonal and therefore neither masculine nor feminine. This is precisely the analysis of a Dr. A.J. Brown, a missions secretary, who said this, "I think we may observe a distinction between the ordination of women to the ministry and their ordination to the eldership," he wrote. "Ordination to the eldership is quite a different matter because eldership is very largely an office of counsel and administration. And I have had some opportunity to judge as to the value of women in administration." And he went on to describe, of course, women's organizational qualities that had been understood since Adam. In the early 20th century, then, to bring this all together, a host of new administrative tasks became vital to the church's mission, and Protestant women could operate duplicators, they could prepare budgets, they could coordinate Sunday schools and other forms of administration. The architectural accommodation for these activities became literal spaces for women to enter Protestant church life in ways that they had not previously. Think about what I said about the church office. The pastor's study, ubiquitous in the church, was filled with theology books, a man's tool for a man's work. But the church office, with its file drawers and its tabletop duplicators, was gendered ambiguous. As a result, Protestants began to see women as fit for ordination to ecclesiastical office. Now, as time would go on, a generation later, as women took on ecclesiastical titles, and as they entered church office spaces and operated printing machines, they helped reshape church life. And while the new work of printing and administration had first introduced women into church office spaces, the presence of women in those spaces informed how Protestants assigned meaning to that work, and we're going to see a generation later women ordained to the ministry as well. But it's interesting to me that Presbyterians admitted women to ordination in 1930 to the ruling eldership, but rejected them as ministers. Why is that? Why is that? And I think the administrative transformation that took place in the early 20th century offers us an answer. And I think we then see the importance of lived behaviors and activities and kind of the furniture of our daily existence and the shaping influence and the culture-shaping influence that can have on us. We should pay attention to our architecture. We should pay attention to what we print, how we print it, the medium that we use and inhabit is one of the very important shaping influences upon Christians. And in a day of technological and social change, we should pay attention to these sorts of things and the meanings that we give to them. There we go. Thank you very much.